Please visit our website, wilpf.org. Dick, do I have that right? TriangleWilf.org. Sorry. It's still a little early for me, and I was up late last night. But welcome this morning. Our guests are Lena Halvorsen. She is the director of the film that's in the area right now, USA v. Al-Aryan. And we also have Abdullah Al-Aryan, the son of Professor Sami Al-Aryan, who is the subject of the film. And they're going to tell us this morning about the case and about Dr. Al-Aryan and about the film. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Lena, tell us a little bit. I know you were already in Tampa in when this all started to unravel. And tell us how you came to make the film about, and what the film is about.
Well, the film is about Dr. Sami Al-Aryan and his family. And Sami Al-Aryan was arrested in 2003, and he was accused of funding terrorism. He was held in solitary confinement for 2.5 years in very harsh conditions, awaiting a trial. And then in the film, I followed the family through the 6-month-long trial. And at the end of the 6-month-long trial, the jury could not find him guilty on any of the counts. But the story didn't finish with that.
Right.
It continued, and it still continues today. Actually, today, Dr. Al-Aryan is still in prison.
Yes, and this is nearly 2.5 years later.
Yes.
So, go ahead.
Yeah, so I was living in the area, and by chance I met Nakhla Al-Aryan, Dr. Al-Aryan's wife. And the case of Dr. Al-Aryan was very visible in the media. I saw it a lot. I read about it in the papers. I saw it on TV. And he was portrayed as a big terrorist. There was like no doubt before the trial started that this was, you know, a big terrorist. And when I met the family, I heard a completely different picture of Dr. Sami Al-Aryan. And when I met his friends and his former colleagues and his, you know, the people in his community, they gave me a whole different portrait of this man than what the mass media told me. So I started to get interested in the case. And I've also made films about the Palestinian-Israeli issue before. I'm interested in the issue. I'm interested in human rights. So it kind of all came together in this story. And when the trial started, I asked the family if I could follow them through the trial, and they were gracious enough to allow me to follow them.
It's a very moving film. I saw it last night, and I hope we'll learn a little bit later where else people can see it. But Dr. Al-Aryan was a professor at the time, a tenured professor, I believe, at the University of South Florida. But was it after his arrest at Florida that the university fired him summarily? And then tell us a little bit about...
Well, my father had been a professor at the University of South Florida since 1986. He'd gotten tenure in the early 1990s. And it was after 9/11, at a time when he, as a community activist, as a civil rights activist, began to kind of take steps to assure the American public that the American Muslim community was patriotic, that they were supportive of their government, and trying to kind of preempt any sort of action on the part of the government. For example, things that we saw with the Patriot Act and with some of the programs that were targeting the Arab and Muslim minorities in this country, that he himself became a target of that. And we saw that through the media on programs like Fox's O'Reilly Factor and other
programs.
And
he appeared on that show at one point, didn't
he? That's right.
That's
right. He was kind of threatened and misled, and you know, they used all their tactics to basically bring him on to kind of defend himself against a lot of these very unfounded allegations that had been taking place by a lot of his kind of more local enemies throughout the years, people who were opposed to the kind of work that he was doing. And it was during this time that the university decided that this has become too much of a disruption for the campus, and so they were taking all sorts of steps to try and fire him. But what they didn't expect was that the faculty unions stood behind him, and at that point even the media began to turn against what the university was doing. He was a tenured professor. He had been exercising his academic freedom. And in fact, most of the activities were more community-based, and they were unrelated to his position. Of course, he teaches computer science and computer engineering. He doesn't teach anything political. And so the government basically tried to come to the defense of the university. And we saw this through the governor of Florida at the time, Jeb Bush, who had personally appointed the Board of Trustees. He had kind of refashioned the entire educational system in Florida, whereas he could appoint his own political cronies and friends into these high positions within the university Board of Directors and Board of Trustees. And he basically came to their help by taking a couple of trips to Washington and trying to ask for some sort of help from the Bush administration at the time. What we later found out through a Time magazine article that was released after the trial in December of 2005 was that through an unnamed FBI source who basically said that having investigated my father for many years, they had never found any wrongdoing, but that the orders came directly from Ashcroft, who was the Attorney General at the time, to come up with an indictment. And those were the marching orders, and that's what they were told to do, and so they went along with that, and that's when we saw in February of 2003, my father was arrested to a lot of media coverage. And within a week, the university was successful in its attempts to fire him, although for over a year it had been trying to fire him and was unsuccessful.
Now, he was held a long time before actually being brought to trial, which is, and this has been, is both a First Amendment and a Sixth Amendment issue. So talk a little bit about that ordeal when he...
Well, when everything happened in February 2003, my father was taken away from us, from our entire family. He was held at a federal penitentiary 80 miles north of Tampa, where we lived. It was difficult to go see him. He was the only pretrial detainee in that entire facility, and on top of that, he was put in the special housing unit, which is meant to punish inmates who misbehave. So it keeps them, it's basically known as the hole. It's where they're put in solitary as punishment for things that they do while they're in prison. And this was where someone who had only just been charged was being kept. He was only given one phone call per month. At one point, that phone call was even suspended for 6 months. We were rarely able to see him. Usually there was a 2 or 3 hour wait outside to be able to go in and see him. He was subjected to all sorts of strip searches, and his contact with his attorneys was extremely limited. Most of the time the lawyers would go, they weren't allowed in. He was not allowed more than half an inch worth of legal documents, so he was never really able to help in his own defense. The indictment alone was over half an inch thick, so you can imagine that there wasn't much room for him to be able to help in his own defense. And so as we prepared for trial, we saw that all the chips were stacked against us, and the government had taken every possible opportunity to really make this as difficult and challenging as possible. The media, of course, was pitted against him the entire time, and we were concerned that we wouldn't find a fair jury in a very poisoned atmosphere that we saw in Florida.
And in fact, though, I mean, that trial went on for
6 months.
6 months, and at the end of it, the jury acquitted on, there were, how many counts was it? 50?
There were four defendants in the case, three along with my father, and among them there was about 200 charges, and they didn't return a single guilty verdict.
For anyone?
Okay. For anyone. Sorry.
They were hung on a few of the counts, right?
Well, there were a few charges in which the jury was 10 to 2 in favor of acquittal, so my father effectively could have been acquitted. However, there were two jurors, and when we've heard later about the discussions that were going on, those two jurors were kind of unable to really justify their position. They simply said, we have a feeling, we don't have to prove anything to you. This was part of the ongoing exchange between the 10 jurors who voted in favor of acquittal and the two who did not. One of the interesting things we noted was that before they became jurors, they were all to fill out surveys about their perceptions locally in the community about different things, and we knew that these two had more reservations regarding their views on minorities, on the American Muslim community. And another interesting thing was that they were both regular readers of the local right-wing newspaper, the Tampa Tribune, which had been attacking my father for about 10 years. And so these were the only two that had answered the question that they were actually readers of the local right-wing newspaper. And so it was on that basis that it made sense that they were the only two that also without any evidence, just felt that they couldn't acquit him on everything.
Okay. So your father was already on the radar, you know, of the not only the local community, but the Bush administration and the Justice Department at this time. So they used this these issues that of which there were just this hung juror, these two people, to then used it against him, and explain how that worked, how they...
Well, my father was acquitted, of course, of all the serious charges, so anything mm-hmm. having to do with violence or terrorism, all that
right.
was nonsense, so that even if you have two relatively biased jurors, even they couldn't justify not acquitting him on those counts. So they acquitted him on all these charges. However, things that were lesser charges were hung, although it was in favor of acquittal, the government decided that they were well within their rights to retry him just on those
based
counts.
On the, yeah. Okay.
Although, just as this was happening, we had a local, very famous businessman who was the founder of the Hooters franchise, and he had been indicted on tax charges, and his verdicts came back hung 6-6. So the jury was split right down the middle, and the government said that was too high of a count to them for them to retry him. And so they actually ended up dropping all the charges against him, whereas my father, who had 10-2 in favor of acquittal, the government said that they were ready to have a new trial. And it was at that point that I think, and Lena shows this in the film very brilliantly, I think, that there was a lot of kind of soul-searching within our family. We were really thinking very long and hard about what to do in that situation. Of course, these trials are not cheap. They take a very devastating emotional and physical toll on us, as well as financial, of course. These are million-dollar cases that lawyers choose to try. And so we were faced with the option of going to a new trial, having to go through this entire process again. It'd probably be a couple of years before we'd even see a courtroom. We'd have to get a new legal team, or the possibility of a plea agreement. And so the negotiations went on for about 4 or 5 months. And it was during that process that my father was able to hammer out an agreement by which he was not going to admit to anything that he did not do. He was not going to admit to anything involving violence or anything involving supporting terrorism. It was simply a matter of helping associates and friends and family members with immigration matters, things of that nature. And so when on the face of it, when you look at the things that he pleaded to, people ask, well, where's the crime? But for face-saving measure, the government needed that agreement to be able to come out with some sort of a victory, and we needed that for them to leave us alone and allow my father to leave the country.
This is a most amazing case. I mean, they've been they've used secret orders on more than one occasion, and this and tell us a little bit about how many times has it been now that he has been they have used subpoena mm-hmm. before the grand jury.
Well, part of the agreement that my father signed with the government basically stipulated that he would be allowed to leave the country immediately, and that all his business had been concluded with the U.S. government, and that was the promise that was made to us by the Florida prosecutors. And so as part of the negotiations, our lawyers, and my father, of course, said, you know, I don't want to be called into any other cases, I don't want to be forced to cooperate. And all the prosecutors in Florida we talked to agreed with that. And so they took out the standard clause in the plea agreement that allows for the possibility of cooperation. That was removed. However, another prosecutor in Virginia, who was very clearly and very openly upset about the way that this case turned out for the government, decided to take matters into his own hands. He personally had my father subpoenaed and brought before a grand jury in Virginia, and forced to testify. And of course, when my father refused, he was held in contempt by a judge in Virginia, stopping the clock on his sentence, which had been very close to running out. And so that's happened twice now, and just recently he was called before a third grand jury, and on that date my father embarked on a hunger strike that he's been on since the 3rd of March of last month. And so it's been over a month now that he's been on a hunger strike. He abstained from food and water initially, and since then he's been taking water, but his health has very vastly deteriorated over the past few weeks. And all of us remain very concerned, because the government, of course, is abusing its power in this situation and is not allowing him to leave. It's not holding up its end of the bargain. And of course, my father remains in limbo, awaiting some justice in this case.
And where is your father right now? Mm-hmm.
He's being held at a local jail in Warsaw, Virginia.
And he's been here at Butner, here in North Carolina, a number of times. Actually, tell us a little bit, because you have a lot of ties to this area.
Yeah, we have a lot of family roots in the Triangle area. My father actually, he came to this country in 1975. He finished his undergraduate work in Illinois, but he very soon came to Raleigh, where he did his graduate work at NC State. I was born here. Both of my sisters were born here. My mother attended Meredith College. We loved it here. We think of our time here with very fond memories. And of course, I ended up coming back here for college 18 years later. So we continue to really love this area. And it was in many ways a place where my father and my mother got their start.
Lena, the film is being shown over the next week and in a couple of other venues. Do you have that? You can tell us where people could go to see it. Yeah. And some of the other events that are built around it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're screening it tomorrow night. Tomorrow night at 6:15 in Greensboro at the Islamic Center. It's at the Greensboro Ballroom. And then on Sunday... No, sorry.
That's okay.
Tomorrow we're in Charlotte at the Islamic Center of Charlotte. Tomorrow at 6:15. And then on Sunday we will be in Greensboro at 6:15 at the Greensboro Ballroom. And then on Monday we will have a screening arranged by the Screen Society at Bryan Center on West Duke Campus.
All right, that's Duke at the Bryan
that's
Center
Duke.
On Monday.
Mm-hmm.
At what time?
And at 8 o'clock. And then both Abdullah and his mother and his sister... And also lawyer Peter Erlinder will be there, so it'll be an interesting...
That really will be. Yeah. 8 o'clock, the Bryan Center on Monday. I hope everyone can make it. This is a very important issue. And go ahead.
And also on Tuesday at 7:15, we will be at the Galaxy Cinema in Cary. Okay. And on Wednesday, the film will be screened at 3 o'clock in Charlotte School of Law. And then in the night at 7:30, it will be screened at the Community Church of Chapel Hill. It's the Balance and Accuracy in Journalism who's arranging a screening.
Right, Balance and Accuracy in Journalism at the Community Church in Chapel Hill. That's the Community Church Unitarian Universalist in Chapel Hill, quite near the university.
And then Friday on April the 11th at 7:30, there will be a screening at the Mass Youth Center. Which I'm not sure where it is, but but we do have a webpage. So if you don't remember all of these
okay.
times and the addresses,
give us that website.
We have a website, and it's www.usavsalarian.com.
No hyphens, no.
No hyphens, nothing.
Okay.
So usavsalarian.com.
Okay.
So if you go there, you can find all the screening times and the directions to places.
Great. Now, the film, you've actually been traveling around the world showing this film. It's appeared in a number of film festivals and won some awards.
Yeah.
Just a little bit about that.
Yeah, I've been traveling around with the film, screening it at festivals, at conferences around the world. We won the award for the best Nordic documentary. We won an award at the New Orleans Human Rights Festival. We won an audience award at the Tromsø Film Festival, so we won several awards on it, and we've screened it. It's been screened in 13 different countries, and it will be aired also in the States finally. It's been very hard to get distribution in the States.
I believe that.
But on April the 7th, you can see the short version of the film on Link TV.
Link TV.
So if you go on linktv.org, you can read about it there.
Okay, great.
And there's also a website that the family has.
Yeah, the website where people can get more information about the case itself and find ways to help is www.freesammynow.com, and that's free Sammy, S-A-M-I, now.com. And I think it's important for people to find some information and try to contact their officials. We're trying to get the Judiciary Committee and Congress involved in this case to conduct an inquiry. We know they've investigated the abuses by the Justice Department in the past, especially under the watch of Alberto Gonzalez, but we hope that they also continue these types of inquiries into the continuous abuses by the Justice Department. I think as we look into the commemoration today of the 40th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, that we think about the continuous abuses. My father has also been subjected to a lot of the same abuses. The government's been spying on him just as they spied on Dr. King 40 years ago. For 9 years, they recorded all of his phone calls and followed his every move. He was also unjustly detained. You know, people don't forget that. And my father's been unjustly detained now for over 5 years.
It's been a tremendous strain on your family. How are they holding up? Your mother and, I mean, it's clearly, it's very palpable in the film, just, you know, how stressful this has been, and frightening and upsetting, and leaving with no closure. And how are they doing?
Well, it's been very difficult, of course, but they found a lot of support within the local community in Florida, especially among the local church groups and the activist groups. And so, you know, that's really what we look to depend on for support. And it makes it a little bit easier, although it's been an extremely trying situation. It's kind of you against the most powerful government in the world. And it seems that every victory is still very limited in its scope because of just the sheer power of the force that you're up against. And so all we hope and look forward to now is just my father's release and being able to move on with our lives. But we obviously appreciate all the help and support that we've gotten so far and continue to get.
Now your mother has been living in Egypt, your mother and your younger siblings. And you and your sister Lila are both living and working in this country. You're at Georgetown working on your doctorate, right? And where is she?
And Layla's at The Nation magazine. She's done a lot of work there on the Iraq War, especially interviewing veterans of the Iraq War.
And you're working now on your PhD in history at Georgetown, and your plans. I mean, you're working on what?
I specialize in Middle East history with a focus on Egypt and social movements there during the period of the 1970s.
Let's see, we've covered that. I wanted to ask a little bit about this plea bargain. There was an appeal that lost in the 11th Circuit Court, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this plea bargain is very confusing in a way, and they've backtracked and broken their part of the agreement any number of times, as we know. Where does that stand right now?
Well, we continue to appeal to the full body of the 11th Circuit. Of course, there was a three-panel judge that heard our appeal, and they did not look on it favorably, although we found their decision, quite frankly, very inexplicable. There was really no reason for them to rule. And what was very obviously a case in which the government had made promises on which it later relented. The problem, of course, is that you have a Justice Department that's talking out of both sides of its mouth. So you have the Florida prosecutors, who we actually negotiated with, saying one thing, which is they did make the promise. They fully admit that. That's been established in all the court documents. However, you have another side of the government.
Can you say what the promise is for the?
Well, the promise, I think, as I said before, is that he wouldn't be forced to cooperate in any other cases, that he would simply have concluded all his business with the United States, and that he'd be allowed to leave the country at the earliest possible date, which we took to mean immediately. And that was the promise. In fact, had my father actually agreed to cooperate, he could have even had more time reduced off of his sentence, but he never did. And that was very clearly established in the way that the negotiations went and in the final outcome of the agreement with the prosecutors.
This is an amazing case. And I understand this is not the only one in this country, but this is a very high profile case and one that's very important, and people really do need to speak out on this. Can you tell us, I know that we have Conyers and Leahy on the Senate Judiciary, and Obama. Now, the presidential candidate Barack Obama, people might contact him. Say a little bit about exactly what people could do.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just because of the urgency of the situation, we have to kind of deal with the administration we have now and find some way to convince them to simply drop all these continuous abuses that they continue to use to basically exact revenge against my father for winning in his trial. And so that means contacting the judge in Virginia who overlooks the entire subpoena process and the government's looking to bring him before continuous grand juries. And so the judge's name is Gerald Lee, and he's based in Virginia, and you can find all of his information on the website freesamynow.com. And he's basically the person who's overseeing this and allowing it to continue. And so I think it's important that he hear from ordinary Americans and people who are concerned about the government's abuse of power in this case. Because we've seen kind of a weakening in terms of the way the judiciary has really come under the thumb of this administration. I think it's important that judges prove that they really are independent arbiters and that they don't fall to the sway of the very highly charged and poisonous atmosphere that's in the politics of fear and hysteria that have overtaken this country over the last 8 years.
Now, the judge, tell us about that. After he was committed, though, the judge... The judge did something that is really incredible to me that he would do. It was what you would call an activist judge. But tell us.
Absolutely. This was actually the judge who oversaw the trial in Florida. This was a different judge than the one I just alluded to. This judge oversaw the entire trial. And just to give you a sense of how he conducted himself in the trial, we submitted over 1,000 motions both before the trial and during the trial. And we did not win a single motion throughout the entire case. And so we took him to be basically an extension of the administration, an extension of the prosecution team even, because of just the bias that he displayed throughout the course of the trial, never giving us one ruling or one decision throughout the entire case. And so we never expected that the judge would be in any way sympathetic. We had seen this through a lot of the racially charged comments and things that were made throughout the trial. And so we thought that at the very least, when the government made a plea agreement with us and recommended the minimum sentence, allowing my father to leave immediately, that the judge would simply go along with what the government itself was demanding at the time. And that was not the case in the end, because the judge came in the day of the sentencing, and it was a day that people thought there was kind of a conciliatory feeling in the air, that this was finally going to come to an end. There was a lot of very relieved faces going into that hearing, and my father even made a very, I thought, gracious statement about the virtues of the American justice system, of course having just won in his trial, and really thanked everyone for their part, especially the American people who came in as jurors and spoke about what they saw in that trial. But what the judge did, of course, was to simply undercut all of the jury's findings. He basically continued his accusations that the jury had found my father innocent on, and used that as justification to continue to hold him for an additional 11 months and gave him the maximum. And he said it in a very kind of, he had a very angry demeanor throughout the entire hearing. And a lot of people were simply stunned and shocked by the behavior of this judge. And of course, later it turns out that around the same time, in fact, only 2 or 3 days before this hearing, the Attorney General of the United States at the time, Alberto Gonzalez, was in Tampa, in the courthouse, only 3 days before the most important sentencing hearing. And so people have told us, at least, that they can't help but wonder if the administration is also influencing the outcome of sentencing hearings by approaching judges or by at least delivering messages and things of that sort. And that's the sense we've gotten from a lot of the people we've talked to in the Tampa Bay area.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us today. Again, this is very important. Please take some action, get involved, go to the website freesamynow.com, and the USA vs. Al-Aryan, A-L-A-R-I-A-N, .com, and you can find out a lot more details about this. There's some incredible coverage. There's a list of articles too that is rather amazing. You can read the story around this and the coverage, and contact the judiciary. And thank you for listening. This has been the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. And you are listening to WCOMLP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro, 103.5 FM. Thank you, and join us again next week.